Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Smell Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Boateng. This week, join me for a very special episode of the podcast where I interview one of my favorite people, Rozanne Cotton, aka my mom. She goes by Rez, works as a nurse, and also recently graduated with a master's degree in clinical mental health counseling. I asked her to join me for a conversation about grief. Losing a sense has huge implications for mental health, and we chat about how it can impact a person, plus ways to cope and manage. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Let's listen in. Hi, and welcome to the podcast. I'm very excited to have you on tonight. For audience members, we'll call you Rez, but for me, I call you Mom. So to get started, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself? So where are you from and where do you currently live?
Well, by birth, I'm from Oregon, and I lived in Oregon until I was 23. And my first big adventure was with your dad, and he had joined the Air Force, and we ended up going to England, where you were born, and then came back to Idaho in 1992. And I just realized when I was preparing for this that I, in particular, have lived in Idaho for 30 years now.
That's crazy. So since I was two, basically. I know what you do, but for the audience, can you share a little bit more about what do you do for work?
As a nurse, I am a registered nurse. Currently, I do clinical care coordination. So what that means is I connect with, I work for a major insurance company. And so what that means is I connect with members and I ask them how they're doing and I check in on them and see what can I do to help them to make their healthcare better, to make their life better. And in the past, before that, I worked as an ER nurse. I've been a nurse for 19, almost 20 years, and I did 14 of my years in direct ER care, ER nursing care, bedside nursing, and as a manager. So you can be a manager, but if you're a nurse, you're still a nurse. You're still going to do care. So that is a little bit about what I do currently. And what else can I answer for you?
Yes, I think that's crazy. 19 years as a nurse already. I remember as a child going with you to school.
Yes.
To your classes.
Yes, you did. You guys used to go with me, all three of you, because your dad was in the military. It was me and the three, you know, my three amigos. And so if I had a class and there was no one around, y'all went with me. And of course, thank goodness it was like the big ones, you know, like in the auditoriums, like philosophy or sociology or the big classes where they didn't really notice that I had three kids sitting in the audience with me.
I can remember going. That's interesting. I wanted to talk with you in particular for the Smell podcast for two reasons, because you actually went back to school. And in addition to being a nurse, you are now a licensed clinical mental health counselor. So I wanted to speak with you a little bit about that and we'll dive into that. But I also wanted to speak with you about your personal experiences with me having anosmia and how all of that went. So let's start with the clinical mental health counseling. So as a nurse already, what interested you in going back to school for a master's degree in that?
Well, working in an ER, you see a lot of grief and loss and tragedy, but you also witness a lot of family dynamics and also alcohol use and abuse. So, I mean, you can see anything in an ER from a baby being born unexpectedly to an expected death for our part as a medical person, I should say, an expected death of an elderly person. So throughout the years, with that huge range of what you see and you experience and you sit by folks and you talk with them and you comfort them, I started noticing a trend. I don't think that's a good word for it, but I started noticing a pattern. That's probably a better word. I noticed folks who were repeat visitors who maybe had mental health concerns. Maybe they were had lost a spouse or a partner or a child, and now we're starting to see them in the ER for collateral issues related to that. So grief affects you as a human, your body. So if you're sick in your soul and you're sick in your heart, that also will make you sick in your mind. And then it's the big circle. So you become sick in your body. And so we're one huge cycle. And so if your heart and your head and your soul and your health aren't in a good place, it affects you. Sometimes they call that somatic, like, and that does not mean that it's not real, but they can say you have a somatic illness. So you have a chronic back pain because, or maybe this one is probably better. You have a chronic headache because you are sad. You're sad. You're missing somebody. So your head hurts and you just can't think about it anymore, but you really don't. A doctor can say, well, you really don't have a headache. Well, how can you tell me I really don't have a headache? I'm telling you, I have a headache, but there's nothing wrong with you. We've taken X-rays. We've taken MRIs. We've taken CT scans. We've done everything that we can do for you. So you're okay. You just have to figure it out. So there's some truth to that, unfortunately, but that's not what a person wants to hear when they have a headache and they don't feel well. And we've shown that there isn't a legitimate diagnostic proof that something's wrong, but it can be your emotions that can cause you to, it can be grief, it can be anger, hate. Those things can cause you to have headaches or body aches or stomach aches or nausea. So I started noticing those things and I started listening and I started thinking, wow, if somebody could just listen to them on a personal level, on a not doctor, nurse, let me listen to you, but as someone who could listen to their concerns objectively and give them a safe place to talk, which nursing does that. But nursing is also a very busy, task-oriented job. So in an ER, we don't have a lot of time to sit. But in the early hours of the morning or the late hours in the evening, when things start to slow down a little bit, we can be at bedside and be more present to hear their personal side of what's going on. And then you make that connection. So in short, that long answer, in short, what made me start thinking about going back for counseling was I kept thinking, man, if somebody could just do that for them, if somebody could just be there and listen to these guys, if somebody could just pay attention to them and say, I understand, I get it. And then it started being like, well, I could do that. Why shouldn't it be me? Why couldn't it be me? And so it started as a little niggling in my mind that, you know, somebody else should be doing this. And then it started changing to, well, you can do it because you know both sides. You know the nursing side and you can be that comfort for them. Therapeutically, you can help. So that is my answer. So I finally, because I'm older, I finally was like, I'm doing this. I'm going to do it. I can do this. And I just finished. So that, Katie, is my answer.
You know, what's interesting to me as I listen to you talk about why you chose to go back to school is you said something that I think of as a motto for my own life, which is the why not me. So I just think that's kind of cool that I inherited that from you and didn't even realize it until this moment.
Yeah. Why not me? Why not you?
Yeah. I thought about that a lot when I started. I helped to get Stana started. A lot of the podcast listeners are familiar with my role with the Smell and Taste Association of North America. And a lot of the times I just think that why not me? So I kind of already have an idea why, but I want to know a little bit more. You went into clinical mental health counseling, but in particular, why did you decide to add extra classes and add an emphasis area on trauma, grief, and crisis to your degree? Because that's on top of, or in addition to the regular program. So why did you decide to pursue that extra piece?
Twofold. Coming from a medical perspective, watching people pass or suffer trauma day in and day out, we are taught as medical professionals to bracket, I guess, put your own personal issues in a box, basically, like put your troubles aside in a box, just like put that over there, because right now your major concern is taking care of this trauma that just came in. Maybe it's a car wreck. And so being an ER personnel, that doesn't just affect the nursing staff. That doesn't just affect the physician. It affects police officers. It affects first responders, the ambulance service. It affects search and rescue. It affects people who ran to the car to help that person, and then they come follow the ER, or they come follow the patient to the ER because they want to make sure that they get there safe, like a standby person who's just like, oh my gosh, I hope it's okay. So, you know, yes, ER, first responder, we see a lot of that. And you think, yeah, but you have trained to deal with that. You should have the skills to handle that. And we do. We do. But sometimes there's just certain things that just break your heart, that just certain people just touch you for whatever reason that is. We don't know. And sometimes situations affect you when you are not expecting that. Like you see ER docs, you come in there, you think, oh, where's their heart in all of this? You know, our ER nurse comes in, she's like, quit your whining, you're fine. You know, you're not dead, right? Well, that response to you is probably not related to just you. It may be that somebody just passed in another room and they are rebounding from that, right? So when I was an ER manager, department manager, when we would have increased traumatic, for instance, the death of a small child or a death of an infant, that is very traumatic. It doesn't matter how professional we are or how much we've trained to be able to roll with the punches emotionally. That affects us. And maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but at some point, it's going to affect you. And if you don't properly process the loss and the grief and the trauma and the crisis of which we witness, then you can have substance use. You can have mental health concerns. And so my focus was, again, use my medical training and my medical awareness and become a specialist in grief and trauma and crisis in counseling, because not just any nurse is just going to go talk to any person. Not just any policeman is just going to go talk to any police, you know, counselor. They want to talk to somebody that knows their life, their story, their experiences, without having to dredge up all of that. And so my focus is grief, trauma, and crisis, because I want to, I don't know that ministering, that's not a good word professionally, but I want to be present and specialize in that area so that people who are in that medical field, first responders, police officers, veterans, military personnel, understand that this is a safe place for them. And she understands what she's aware. Maybe I don't understand, but I'm aware of what their trauma and crisis and grief is.
That's an amazing answer. So I think that's really cool that you decided to kind of go forward and add that extra emphasis area onto your degree. So I wanted to speak with you in particular, again, I mentioned it before, but I think as someone who has experienced a loss in my life, even though it's not a death or something like that, I grew up with a sense of smell. And then when I was 18, I lost it. And so since then I've dealt with not having a sense of smell and also not really having any flavor perception. So I'm able to taste things like the five basic tastes, but I can't perceive the differences in flavors like strawberry versus raspberry yogurt, really. It's just all kind of sweet to me. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to you about this a lot before since you're my mom and we're pretty close. But one of the things I wanted to bring you on and talk about, and I think that people in the anosmia community want to hear about too, is I feel like it's a grieving process, right? I've had a loss in my life that has dramatically impacted me. And I think that I've gone through some of those emotions that are, that you do when you're grieving. So let's talk about that a little bit. So what is the grieving process exactly, if people aren't familiar?
Okay, so Elizabeth Kubler-Ross wrote a book on death and dying. And she was inspired by working with people who were terminally ill and trying to figure out, she wrote this book, I just recently read it again, and she wrote it for instruction of medical people. Like, this person says they're dying of a terminal illness. And back in the 60s at the time, a little history, a lot of times doctors wouldn't even tell you what your diagnosis was. They might come in and they might tell your husband or they might tell the parent or somebody, but they weren't telling you that, well, you're dying and you have 4 to 6 weeks or you have 4 to 6 months. So they wouldn't tell patients what the situation was. And in their thought at the time, they thought that was best not to tell someone they're sick and dying. And then the spouse wouldn't tell them that they were sick and dying. Well, Elizabeth or Dr. Kubler-Ross, she was like, I don't really think, she's a psychiatrist, she goes, I don't really think that that's the best way to handle people who are sick. So she did a study on it, her and another person, and they started interviewing terminally ill patients. What do you wish your doctor would tell you? And a lot of them were like, the truth? Like, just tell me. Let me make the decision whether or not I can handle this. Don't make decisions for me. And so through that really amazing process of interviewing all of these different folks, she started to see that there were kind of specific stages in the grief process. And one of those, a series of different emotions, and she outlines them as having denial, like so-and-so is dead. What? No, they're not. And everybody, but they can't be. You're joking me. That's not true. And then once we start to process that, oh my gosh, she's not joking. They really are dead. Then we start getting angry. We get furious. We're angry at the person for dying. We're angry at the person that accidentally killed them. We're angry at life, period. We're angry at God. That's another one. We're angry at our higher power. And then we start making deals, you know, God, you know, or whoever my higher power is, if you could just bring him back, like we start bargaining and we start making deals, like, please bring him back. And then that doesn't work. We kind of go into this depression. And then after that stage, we get to what we hear a lot is acceptance. Like, and the misunderstanding with acceptance is that doesn't mean, oh, I'm good today because I just accepted the fact that for myself, I accept that my brother has passed. Like, it's not that easy. And I think one of the things I would like folks to know about grief is that it isn't timely. Like, Katie, you said once in one of your interviews that struck me, there's like, and I'm paraphrasing, so I'm not probably going to get it right, but there are tiny moments of sadness, tiny moments of sorrow. So mm-hmm. You're minding your business, you know, and you think, I'm good today. I think I'm accepting that I can't smell anymore. And then something comes along and you're like, I'm really sad about this, which is really confusing a lot of times for a person who has feels as though they've worked through their grieving process, right? my own personal example is I had a brother who passed, and I went through, I didn't know these were the stages at the time, but I absolutely went through grief. I mean, the grief process of denial and anger and bargaining and depression and then accepting it. But that doesn't mean, oh, in 6 months after you've gone through 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 stages of grief, you're going to get better. Grief it is a continuum.
It goes up and down.
Yes, it ebbs and it flows. And as it comes and it goes, it gives us a moment to grow a little bit. When it ebbs away, it comes on strong and you think your heart is going to break and your brain is going to break and you're never going to recover. But then it kind of lets up a little bit. And in that moment of where you think you're never going to get better, you actually get a little stronger. And acceptance does not mean getting over. So mm-hmm. I want people to understand, accepting does not mean you're over it. I have this mental vision of getting a little, it's like working out, you know, you start, you're weak, you can't lift 5 pounds, you can't lift 10 pounds, you can't. So as you build your emotional strength for that next flood of emotions, you will be stronger the next time you get flooded, right? So when you said tiny moments of sadness of these things that come on, that's exactly what grief is. So they don't flood you so much that you drowned. And in the very beginning, that's how we feel in our grief. We feel like we are gonna drown and we're never gonna recover. So we emotionally get stronger as we start to accept. And that doesn't mean get over. It means that we're growing in the knowledge of what has happened, and that emotionally we are able to bear that grief a little bit more, but it doesn't go away.
Right.
They say time's a great healer. You know, you just want to choke people when they say that, because it's like, yeah, sure it is. Thanks for that uplifting bit of information.
What you're saying is really wise, because for my own experience, I know that in the beginning, when I first lost my anosmia, when I first lost my sense of smell, I don't think either you or I had ever heard of the word anosmia. And I went through the experience of trying to go to the doctors and figure it out, go to our family doctor where we're from. And I was referred on to an ENT, then referred on to like a neurologist, and then kind of just left out in the world without any reason or understanding of what really happened to me. So I think in the beginning, I like went back and forth between like anger and then just strong, strong denial. Like, yeah. I don't think I spoke about having anosmia much at all in the very beginning. It took me like quite a few years. I've been on the podcast before with other people of saying, like, I think it was really when I moved to New Jersey that I started to like unpack all of the emotions of dealing with having no sense of smell, because I had just put it away in a box and like tucked it up on a shelf because it was so hard. And then when we moved here, Stephen and I had time where I was looking for a job and I wanted to do a podcast about it because I had more time to think about it. And that was actually 2018 when we moved. That was a huge change in my life. And then also like diving into the anosmia topic of my own self was a big deal, because I started to like really look at it and how did I feel about it? And I became anosmic in late 2008, early 2009. So it's been 13 years now. So I, from that time frame until about 2018, I did think about it every once in a while, but not a lot. And then in 2018, I just really kind of decided to accept, as you're saying, like accept the situation and welcome in the emotions. So that is again why I was excited to have you here, for your background with the mental health counseling, because I think that sometimes people feel that grief can only apply to death. And I don't feel that way. I feel like I definitely lost something. And even though it wasn't a person, it was a big part of my life.
Well, if you can look back at, you know, Dr. Kubler-Ross doing this big study and writing a book in 1969, okay, if they're just now, back then, becoming aware of that people were even experiencing these emotions and not tabooing them, like, oh, well, you're dying, but let's not tell them they're dying. Okay, let's see if they can just pass away without noticing that they're dying.
Right.
How ridiculous, right? I mean, today's in 2022, to think that a doctor could come in and not tell you what is happening to you, right? Mm-hmm. We should have that knowledge and that choice to decide whether or not you want to fall into a fetal position and rock until you die, or give you the strength to make decisions on how you want to end, live the end of your days, right? Which would we rather have? Ignorance or the ability to make good decisions about how you want to live the rest of your time? So with saying that, if we just discovered in 1969-ish this phenomenal new thought that there's an actual grieving process to death and dying, and then apply it to the fact that you can grieve the loss of a spouse that you divorce. You can grieve the loss of a pet. And this is probably where I'd like to introduce the word disenfranchised grief, which is really very, which kind of talks about, explains the situation that you went through. So when I first started talking to you about people coming to the ER saying, I have a headache. Okay, so you have a headache, but I'm telling you as the doctor, there's nothing wrong with you because we can't find anything. Does that mean that person's headache does not exist? It's right. Still there, right? So you going to a doctor and saying, I'm not smelling anything. Like, I can't smell anything. So you go to these doctors and what does he say? There's nothing there, Kate. There's nothing that should be making you not smell. So have a great life. I'll see you later.
Exactly.
Right? So what is that? Does that make you feel any? No, it makes you feel disenfranchised. And let me explain what disenfranchised means. It means having a situation that is not the societal norm, right? So your dad and I are divorced. If your dad was to pass, I would be heartbroken, right? But I'm remarried. Should I be like, my husband would be like, upset that I would say that? No, my husband now would understand that I would be sad about the loss of your dad. God forbid that anything would happen. So the example that I'm using is that's disenfranchisement, because I, as his ex-wife, should not have the right or the societal approval to be sad. Because he's not my husband anymore. But that doesn't mean that you still don't grieve the loss of that person. And so society, if they haven't recognized, and you are aware of this, with having anosmia, when you started researching it and you started the podcast and you started investigating it, you found out there's very little information about anosmia. Mm-hmm. There's hardly any support groups or knowledge-based resources for folks with anosmia or parosmia or any of the smell disorders to link together and talk about. So you feel very isolated. And I don't mean you, Katie. I mean you, anyone with anosmia or anyone who has lost a family member to suicide. Should I not grieve because somebody died of a suicide? Right? So society says, well, that probably is something we're just not going to talk about because we're uncomfortable with that. Right? So if anosmia hasn't become a social norm, and I'm not sure that that's the proper term for that. But if anosmia hasn't come in to social awareness and you can't smell, a perfect example of that, Katie, is when you were getting your hair cut and the guy says, I love the smell of this stuff. And you said, I can't smell. So he nips this stuff on your nose. Like, yeah. What the heck, dude? You're shoving shampoo or conditioner in my nose holes isn't going to change the fact that I can't smell. It just makes you rude, right?
Yeah. But
it doesn't come across their brain that you can't. Well, try harder. Like, here, let me stick it in your nose hole. Because it's not really his fault that he's ignorant in that situation. It's because anosmia hasn't become a societal term, like having someone that is blind or having someone that is deaf, right?
Yeah.
Those terms have come into society's awareness.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that part of this conversation that I was excited to have with you is the fact that anyone who's listening, you're allowed to feel grief over your loss. Yes. For a smell or taste disorder. I don't know if you need to hear that or not, but I think that I give you permission, if that helps at all. I know, especially now in light of COVID, there's a lot of people who have a smell or taste disorder and a lot of people who are experiencing smell distortions. So anything that they do smells horrible and awful. And a lot of people are really struggling with that and their mental health. I've been on record as saying that I'm grateful that I did not experience parosmia because I would rather have it how I have it now, with nothing, than deal with that, because that can really impact your state of mind. Like, you can't eat any food, everything smells awful. So that one in particular is really hard. So I think it's okay for people to grieve what their life was like before, even if it's not the standard definition of grief equals someone died. I don't think that that's grief. I think grief equals you lost something.
Yes. Grief can be the loss of a dream, something that you wanted to become. Maybe you wanted to become an airplane pilot, but you have poor vision.
Right.
And you've wanted to become an airplane pilot since you were in high school or junior high, right? But as you start going through life, you find out you have some rare eye disease. Well, that would be disenfranchised grief, right? Because I know that's what I wanted to do. I know that my heart and soul was dedicated to this dream. And now I can't do it because I'm not good enough, right? I have a failing. I have a condition. The words that we use in our head are, I'm not worthy. I have failed. I'm not good enough. I'm not. Well, that is true. But then the people who, it is true that you are unable to reach the goal that you set, but it's not true that you are the problem. If I can make that clear.
Right.
And that impacts people's emotional and mental health and their physical health. So it's a loss of a goal. It's a loss of a dream. It's a loss of a pet. If you don't like animals, then you probably won't connect with that, right?
Yeah.
If you don't like flying airplanes, you and I aren't going to connect with the fact that that guy had this amazing dream in his life and a goal and he can't meet it, right? So it's disenfranchised for him because we don't get it.
Right.
I'm not connected to that dream like he is. But that doesn't mean it isn't real grief. And grief is not time limited. Like, we have to work the process of adapting to and embracing the change that has happened. And that key right there is when people have a really hard time of processing through and making new life goals and moving forward, taking action like you did, creating a podcast, opening up that box, looking in there and seeing, how do I really feel about this? How has this affected my life? And why isn't there any information on that? Mm-hmm. And what I thought was amazing is you said, there's nothing on this. There's very little on this. So why not me? Why don't I do this podcast? Why don't I be the person that looks to find, are there others out there like me who are going through this grief process? Right. Who are experiencing this? And when you start reaching out beyond yourself is where you start connecting with your tribe, your people who can support you in how your emotions are, and they can validate your emotions. And so your tribe is like, I'm part of the Anosmic tribe. Mm-hmm. Wasn't where I was looking to go, but right. They're my tribe now, right? Exactly. There are others like me, and I feel like they feel.
Yeah, I think that's, yeah, I definitely didn't anticipate that I would be leading a nonprofit organization focused on smell and taste disorders as a little girl, you know, it's definitely right? Not where I was going to go. But it's, I'm proud to be here, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hi everyone. I want to tell you all about an exciting opportunity, which I have personally participated in before. My friend from Falk Aromatherapy, Frauke Gallia, runs the 21-day Jumpstart Smell Training Program, which is a habit-building program designed for acquired anosmics, hyposmics, and parosmics. The next program starts on Monday, July 11th. It is an email-based program so that it can easily be integrated into your schedule and daily life. And importantly, it allows you to be located anywhere in the world to join. You'll get your daily email first thing in the morning. The program includes pre-program setup support and guidance, e-journal and workbook to record progress and stay motivated, 21 days of inspirational emails, an optional smell buddy to help keep you accountable, and 3 recorded motivational mindset coaching videos from Frauke. Plus, you'll also receive free re-registration to future smell training sessions for ongoing support and motivation if you like. So once you're in, do as many future sessions on Frauke as you want. I've done the program before and it's excellent, so make sure to click on the link in the episode notes to sign up now. So one other question that I have for you is kind of just popping into my head as we're chatting. So you have a lot of inside scoop on my life since you are my mother. What do you remember about that time when I first became anosmic?
Well, I have some grief myself about the whole situation. I mean, I still feel sad that you lost your smell, but like you were so sick. In fact, we thought you might have West Nile is where it started. Because Kate got so sick and she was in her room, she couldn't lift her head off the pillow. And I kept taking her back to the emergency room and to the doctor. And they're like, she's just got a virus. She'll be fine. Well, okay. But I think she's going to die. I mean, you were so sick. Right. And so then it was kind of subtle, you know, because it was like, it wasn't all of a sudden that you didn't smell. Right. I think with COVID, a lot of people are, and this is a comparative grief. I want to talk, hopefully I can remember to talk to you about the comparative grief. So it's not like, oh man, I can't smell anymore. I mean, it took a few years, if I remember right, Kate, where you were.
Yeah. I remember being sick and then I can't remember the timeline exactly, but I remember that I was really sick over that first winter of college again. Mm-hmm. And from after that, like in the spring, when I was living with the 5 other girls at the school, that's when I noticed that I couldn't smell anymore. So I think the time you're referring to when I was really sick was a few years before. And I think it did impact smell.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah. And this one in particular, I got a really bad upper respiratory infection. Again, so I think I had a series of of those.
Right. And so when you started saying, I can't smell, I have really bad allergies. So I was thinking, well, just blow your nose. You know, it'll come back, you know, you're fine. So, and I'm a nurse and I was like that, blow your nose, you know, maybe you need to see an allergist, or maybe we need to see an ear, nose, and throat doctor, which you did. You started that process to do all of that. So even as your own parent, I heard you, but I guess I was like the guy in the washbowl doing your hair. Oh, just blow your nose, Katie. You'll be able to smell, right? Mm-hmm. So I didn't really get the gravity that you absolutely could not smell. I'm hoping people understand that. Like,
right.
You know, like, I can't taste anything. What is the first thing we say to people? Well, go brush your teeth. You know, maybe get tongue scum or something. I don't know. Go figure it out why you can't taste. But at first I didn't realize that was even a thing. Honestly, I feel terrible about that. So yeah. And then I questioned you. So I'm sure others would question, well, are you sure you can't smell?
Right.
Right. So again, if anosmia had been part of my medical training and awareness, maybe I would have been like, oh man, okay, let's do this. But I feel like I had a lack of urgency almost about right. it. Yeah, like it'll come back is really my lack of, when I'm looking back at it now, the feeling that I see was I had a lack of urgency because my expectation was it would eventually come back.
Right. Well, I mean, that's what typically happens.
Right.
So I think if it makes you feel better, you're not the only person who is that way. So I think that's the goal of Stana and the organization. And now one of my life goals is to raise awareness about how important it is to pay attention if someone does say that they can't smell, because right. it might come back, but it could also be like a really big issue.
Yeah, I think that is a key point right there, is having hope that yes, it might come back, but to have the mental health awareness to prepare if it doesn't.
Yeah.
Like, what are we doing to support folks whose smell isn't going to come back?
Exactly.
Is that a conversation that we are having with people, especially now? I think COVID, like you mentioned, really has brought anosmia to the forefront, but it brought it to the forefront related to a pandemic,
right?
Not to the onesie twosies, you know, this person here has anosmia, that person in England has anosmia, this person was born without any sense of smell. Right. Like, so you guys have been around for a really long time. It wasn't like you all of a sudden just happened.
Right.
It's been around. So I think societal awareness, remember we talked about disenfranchisement. So society has now become very aware of anosmia related to COVID. Mm-hmm. So that's a bonus, an unfortunate bonus, that now awareness is increasing about this situation. It doesn't help those of you that for years have been struggling with it,
right.
Emotionally, but in the future, I think there will probably be more resources and funding geared towards figuring this out, because it has now come into societal's awareness.
Right. And one thing you wanted to talk about a little bit more was the comparative grief.
Yeah.
You want to dive into what you mean by that?
So I don't even know that it's a term. Maybe I'm coining my own term here. But what I've noticed, Katie, from listening to your podcast is that a lot of concerns have been brought up from different interviewees that you've had on the podcast, that people will say to them, oh, well, so you can't smell, you can still see.
I call it comparative disability.
Oh, okay.
It's the same thing, comparative grief or comparative disability. It's the whole comparative thing.
Right. So I'm comparing my, you know, as my grief level. Well, I had somebody who died. You just can't smell. Like, right. Mm-hmm. Really? So at least you can still see. And the reason I want to bring up this term is because comparative grief, it doesn't matter if you've lost a fingernail, a wish, a dream, a goal, a leg, a nose, whatever it is. Your grief is your grief. Your grief is not measured, and your response to your grief isn't measured by my grief. Okay, I'm not you and you are not me. And we all have different stories in life. And so when I say our stories, the narratives that we have in our head is, and people do it to try to make us feel better, right? That they say, you know, I'm sorry you can't smell, but look, you could get a dog, right? So it sounds like they're trying to
help.
Like in there, sometimes it feels like they're discounting. They're uncomfortable. So let me back up a little. So the reason, a lot of times, the reasons people do that are because they're uncomfortable with having the conversation of, oh, you can't smell? Well, that's okay. Let's go to pizza. Right? They don't want to really know, because then they'll have to think about it.
Right.
Figure that out. We see that a lot with death of someone who maybe took their own life, you know, died by suicide. Okay, so if someone dies in a car wreck, the appropriate grief and the grief that we get from society is, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry for your loss, right? That's our normal approach. Someone dies by suicide, you don't hear anything, because they don't know what to say, right? So if you say, I've lost my sense of smell, they say, oh, I'm sorry, right? But they, or they say, oh, well, at least you're not blind.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that a lot.
Yeah, right? Like, I mean, or at least you can hear. So it's goodwill, and it's meant to come as goodwill. But having a disenfranchised and unknown societal norm of loss makes it uncomfortable for people to address. And so they're trying to make us feel better by saying, you know, oh, you lost a baby by miscarriage. That's okay. You're still young. Mm. You can have another baby, right? So there's that mourner. You're a mourner. I'm a mourner in my own losses in life. And those things that have caused me to mourn is grieving. Grieving and mourning, we move through those processes and we learn to accept them, which does not mean we are okay with them. It just means that we learn how to embrace. I feel like you have learned and are learning how to embrace anosmia. Mm-hmm. Which makes me very proud, instead of just shoving it down and bracketing and putting it in a box, which you probably got from me as well, putting it in a nice box with a bow on it until I have a moment to have a moment. Okay, let's put that up over there until I'm ready to deal. Right. So, so grieving, does not have a timeline, and comparative grief by others, I think we could just look at it as an innocence on their part to try and understand something they don't understand. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Instead of wanting to wring people's necks, because yeah, you're right. I could have another kid, but I still can't smell.
Right.
So,
well, one of the things that I think you're aware of just because of our relationship is that there unfortunately are not a lot of treatment options for people with smell and taste dysfunction. So sometimes people will prescribe like smell training, which doesn't always work for everyone. Mm-hmm. It usually works better if it's for someone who has recently lost their sense of smell. But there's no like magic pill for people. And that's really hard. And so I guess I'm happy that we're having this conversation and talking about mental health. I'm a big mental health advocate, and I think it's important to manage that. So what advice do you have for someone who maybe is experiencing smell or taste dysfunction to manage their mental health?
First off, find a tribe, find people like you, find people who, and I think there's more resources out there. There's more awareness. So one thing is to try to find information about it, which from your experience and my experience, there was not and is not a lot of information. I even pulled up research journals because that's one of my favorite. I'm a little bit of a nerd with this, but I love to read medical research information on mental health or anosmia or grief and dying. That's how I came across Dr. Kubler-Rice's information, or Ross. So do some research, look, and don't give up. Okay, that's an important part of it. Talk about it,
mm-hmm.
Right? Remind people. I know that this is something that's hard for me, and I know it's very hard for Katie, is we forget that you guys can't smell, right? And so to be like, oh, smell this. Ah, crap. I'm sorry. You know, or as I'm shoving something towards your face, right? Or I send a text, oh, Katie, these roses smell so good, right? And then I feel like, oh, dang it, I did it again. You know, like,
well, I think you actually do a really good job of that now. In the beginning, not so much, but I think that you've definitely improved. And one thing that you have started to do, and I think you realize that you do it, is you describe smells for me.
Yes.
Which is really, it's wonderful that you do that. So including me in that experience, because I did grow up with a sense of smell until I was like 18 years old. So I can remember sort of what most of the stuff smells like. So you've started to do that, which I just think is wonderful. So maybe that's some good advice too, that I can add for anyone.
Yeah. I think that's a really good idea. It came across my mind. So I grew up in Oregon, and Oregon is so lush and green. And Katie smelled for a clear up until she was, you know, college, almost, you know, college level. So she has a, a meter of smell. Like she has something by which to gauge a memory.
A dictionary.
Exactly. Good term. So you have a dictionary of the rose that was outside your bedroom window. Do you remember mm-hmm. what that smelled like? Okay, mm-hmm. So it sort of smells like that, but like a little more orange smell to it. So I think for family members for somebody who lost their smell later, that dictionary, like pulling up that dictionary, well, you remember how it smells at the Oregon coast, that kind of salty, you know? So I try to paint a picture. So visually, kind of like sensory picture for Kate when I'm trying to describe what something smells like. And then something that Kate did for me, and thank you for having patience with me, for family, is maybe explain, this is how Katie explained to me what it was like to have anosmia, okay? I love bread. French bread, like baguettes and hot bread out of the oven. Okay. If you've never smelled that, there's nothing to measure your smell, that experience by, right? But Katie has smelled that in the past. And she knows how much I love bread, right? And butter. So one day I said, Katie, what is it like? Like when I really understood you can't smell. And Katie said to me, and it really broke my heart, just so you know. Katie said, Mom, imagine that you were standing outside a French pastry shop. And Kate and I have been to France together way back. She goes, imagine standing outside the window of a bakery and being enclosed in a glass box and you smell nothing. And knowing how much I love bread and that smell, I was just like, when I think of you and not smelling, that is the vision I have of myself in a little glass box outside a bakery in France.
Yeah. Wow. I don't even remember saying that to you.
Yeah, you did. It really brought home.
What a profound thing to say that I don't even remember.
But right?
So I think the Dutch Anosmia Patient Association has been around for a really long time. I'm sharing this for a reason. So their name in Dutch is Rooksmakstoornis. I hope I'm saying that correctly. But I think it translates either the name of the organization or the name of the magazine that they publish. And I can't remember what it's called, but one of those things means behind glass. That's the name of their publication, I believe.
Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a good analogy. It's like you have a piece of glass in between you, or like some people, I've heard it described online as like black and white TV versus color.
Yeah. Yeah. I really connected with you putting me in a glass box outside a French pastry shop.
Really?
You know how I love my bread. And I was like, oh, that is worse than not having butter. I mean, that's just bad. Right. Yeah. But I think the point to that is for you who have anosmia, try to, connect with us that are not anosmic in a way, like Katie connected it to me in a way that was meaningful, right? Like I got it in that moment. And I think reminding us smellers in a gentle way, and I know you get frustrated with us. I know. And that's part of that tiny moments of sadness, those little moments of grief that just come back and you're like, again, Mom, I can't smell hot baking bread. Like, okay. So now I know I correlate not smelling bread with being in a glass box. So trying to make whatever that connection is to your people, to your family, to your partners, in a way that makes sense to them. And I don't know what that is. You know, I don't know what that is. And that's another thing I've heard you guys talk about on your podcast is, I don't want to tell people again. I don't want to explain it again. I don't want to repeat it again. You know, like, do you tell people? Do you take the time to tell people? Yeah. Most of the time you guys don't, because it's useless. It doesn't matter to them. Like you're not going to see them again. So why would I take the time to explain it? But for those of us who are standing by and we want to be your support, please don't get tired of trying to tell us again or remind us again, because I've heard Katie say this before, it's a non-visual thing. I can't see that it's a handicap. I don't have a visual reminder. You know, your guys' noses aren't painted bright red. Like, do you know what I mean? Like,
right.
It's unseen. So unseen means we forget. And so that I'm sorry for, you know, I apologize for, you know, the moments when we say, smell this. Oops, sorry.
You haven't done that in a long time. So thank you.
You're welcome. I try.
Well, this is such a good conversation. I'm so happy to have you on and talk to you. Is there anything else that you'd like to add? Any last thoughts?
Don't give up on yourself. People have to find their meaning to their loss, right? I can't tell you what your meaning is for what your purpose is for that loss. But we each individually have to find the meaning behind to me. I have to find the meaning behind my loss, and I have to embrace that and quit fighting, you know. And we're all going to be in a different spot. So I can't judge if you're in an angry spot and I'm now maybe close to my embracing, accepting. I'm still going to have tiny moments of sadness and grief. It's going to come. It's going to come at a way as a wave. Sometimes it just sneaks up on you and gets you. Mm-hmm. So I think to be kind to yourself when you are sad and embrace that you are sad. There is a technique that I really like, and I use it with clients for counseling. And I'm not sure if I've shown you, Katie, the butterfly tap. There is a YouTube link to that explains how to do it. And it literally is just crossing your arms, holding, like giving yourself a one hand onto the other bicep. And you literally just pat left, right, left, right, left, right. And you only do it for a few minutes, and you take some deep breaths and you breathe in and out. And you can literally say to yourself in your moments of sadness, I'm sad. And then you pat, you just do this tapping back and forth. It's been proven to work. They use it in major crises across the world. It's been taught to disengage that fear and sadness and the traumatic experience. It helps to ground people. And it's called butterfly tapping. And you can look it up. And it is, it's almost like a bilateral stimulation from left to right on each side of your head. But while you're doing that, you are comforting yourself and you're acknowledging that you're sad. And you are acknowledged, you can acknowledge that you're angry. You acknowledge whatever emotion you are having in the moment. And then you tap it out.
You'll have to share the link with me, and I can put it in the episode notes for everyone to check out.
Yeah, it's really very helpful. It's been very effective. I teach people how to do it, because when you cross your hands over left, right, first thing I always ask people is, what do you feel? And they always say, oh, I feel warmth. Because you can feel your warmth of your hand touching your own skin, right? And it's instant soothing. It's like, oh yeah, I kind of feel a little bit of warmth there. That's good. Yeah. But it's embracing, kind of symbolic. It's embracing the emotion that you're having in this very moment and tapping it out. Like just a little tap, like you would on like, hey, come here, let me talk to you. So it's very good. I'll send the link to you, Katie.
And I can share that.
Yeah, it was introduced in, it's kind of a subgroup of EMDR, but they did it in mass crisis situations, like in tsunamis, earthquakes, and things like that, because people were so traumatized and stuck. They needed something to decrease that traumatic experience in the very moment. And there were not enough counselors or enough helpers. So they started teaching folks how to, as a group, I can stand in front of 50 people and I can explain very, very quickly how to do this. And it disengages that traumatic experience. Doesn't take it away, just disengages, and it gives people some comfort. So I know we're talking about anosmia and we're not talking about tsunamis or earthquakes, but it still applies. And I use it in counseling. And my clients love it. So give it a try.
Yeah. Thank you for that tip. Make sure everyone listening checks it out as well. Well, I want to say thank you, Mom. Thank you, Rez, for coming on the podcast and talking with us all a little bit more about the grieving process. It's always lovely to chat with you, and I'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Love you. Bye.
Thank you to Rez, aka Mom, for coming on the podcast to share her insight and wisdom with all of us. I think after listening to our chat, you'll think she's super great, just like I do. If you'd like to check out the butterfly effect grounding technique that she mentions, I've added the link to the episode notes, so make sure to check that out. The Smell and Taste Association of North America is the first patient organization focused on smell and taste disorders in the USA. To find out more, visit STANA's website online at www.thestana.org. STANA is an official 501c3 nonprofit, so any donations are tax deductible. We're still fundraising to help all of us with smell and taste disorders, so please donate on our website if you can. Check out the latest series of programming called STANA Live Sensory Insights on Instagram, where we interview people from the world of taste and smell. You can visit our Instagram page to view all of the previous interviews, and you will also now find STANA on YouTube. For any questions or if you'd like to get involved, please visit the website or email us at info@thestana.org. Please rate, review, and subscribe to the Smell Podcast. Reviews are helpful because they allow others to find the show. And if you'd like to financially support the podcast, you can do so by clicking on the link in the episode notes. I appreciate your support. And thank you to everyone who's currently contributing to the show, because your generosity is what makes the podcast possible. Until next time, have a great day.